You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way, and those of you concerned about gun violence. Apparently, Sheila Jackson Lee, the representative for a part of Texas in which a shooting just occurred, Lone Star College in North Houston, was attending a meeting on preventing gun violence when the meeting was interrupted with the news. It's interesting. I just hit the Drudge website. You know, they like to have breaking news. Their top story is that apparently one of the people who sang at one of Obama's balls was lip-syncing. That's their big news, you know, faking it. Yeah. But the actual breaking news as of this moment, and keep in mind this is, as it was with Newtown, going to be subject to 100 revisions over the next week and certainly over the next few hours. But here's the initial report. Igor Volsky, reporting over at the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org. And I'll just read it straight out with that attribution. At least two people were shot in a shooting at Lone Star College in North Houston, Texas, sometime before 12:30 p.m. Now, that'd be Texas time. That would have been about a half hour ago. Witnesses on the scene say the shooting may have escalated after a heated argument, possibly over a bad grade. Hey, guns on campus. Hey, what could go wrong? Both victims had, quote, multiple gunshot wounds, ABC 13 reports, and are in serious condition. They will be brought into surgery at Ben Taub General Hospital. One of the victims, who was shot in the leg, is a school employee. The other, a younger student, was found on the ground unconscious with his eyes closed. The college, as well as other neighboring schools, are on lockdown. Lone Star College has been evacuated. Igor Volsky continues to report at the Center for American Progress's Think Progress blog that witnesses report hearing at least five gunshots and say there may be two shooters, one of whom is in police custody. The shooter may also have been injured. Another shooter ran from the library into an administration building and may have fled the scene into a wooded area. 10 ATF agents are on the way to help search for a second gunman. Wow, ATF has 10 agents. With all the these efforts over the last decade or so by Republicans to defund ATF and limit their scope and not make sure that they haven't had a director for 6 years. They apparently have 10 agents in Texas. Ben Taub General Hospital officials don't expect to receive any more serious patients. According to Fox News, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat from Texas, who represents Lone Star, said she was in a gun violence prevention meeting upon learning of the shooting. The Lone Star website states that the college employs armed police officers and unarmed security guards. So now you know pretty much everything I know about it. We will keep you up to date as we go along on this. We'll see where this is going. And I have a feeling that, you know, the thing that I really wanted to rant about today is going to be subsumed by, you know, yet another shooting and another day's discussion on guns and what to do about guns and gun violence and violence in the United States. But that said, I don't want this story to vanish. I think this is the biggest deal happening right now is not that the president came out as a liberal in his State of the Union address yesterday. Or his inaugural address, rather. Although I think that's a pretty big deal. I think the biggest deal is that yesterday, Senator Henry Marsh, a Democrat, a state senator in the state of Virginia, and a Democrat, was invited to attend President Obama's inauguration. He is, I believe he's in his late 70s. He is a storied civil rights figure. And the Virginia State Senate is 20, there's 40 seats, and the 20 of them are held by Democrats, 20 by Republicans. And, you know, in state after state, after the 2010 election, after the 2000 census, there has been state after state where the states are controlled by Republicans, where they've been gerrymandering their states to create Republican majority, to create a state where even though Democrats vote the majority in the state, in other words, they're blue states, they send a majority of the representatives that they send to the House of Representatives are Republicans. And they do this by extreme gerrymandering, messing with these districts. And this, of course, requires a vote of the legislature. And in Virginia, what had been blocking that was that the Senate was 20-20. And so this one Democratic senator leaves town to go to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. And the Republican senators convene a session and pass the gerrymandering, meaning that after the next election, there will be pretty certainly 21 Republicans and 19 Democrats rather than 20-20 in the Virginia State Senate. And then on top of that, Governor Bob McDonnell says, yeah, he would consider this, he's going to consider this and maybe even this, they call it proportional, it's really not, this plan to assign electoral college votes for the president based on who won, which presidential candidate won which congressional district. Right now, whoever wins the state. But with Virginia and Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin and Indiana, with a couple of these states, maybe Florida, possibly Texas, in a couple of these states, if they can get three or four or five of these states to go with this, they call it proportional representation, although that's something, you know, really quite different. To go with this scam that I am guessing came out of the bowels of one of the Koch brothers funded think tanks. You will see in the 2016 presidential election, a Republican elected president, even if a Democrat gets, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 million more votes. Because what they're doing is they're taking all the swing states and making them no longer swing states. They're making them states that will reliably send a Republican to the White House. I mean, this is just absolutely amazing. This is something that the Republicans have been working on for years, at least a decade. And, you know, in the background, quietly, methodically, big money behind it. Take control of state by state, do it from the bottom up, state representatives, state senators, all this unsexy stuff that nobody's paying attention to, and then get them to pass voter ID suppression laws, voter suppression ID laws, and then ultimately get them to pass a change in the way that the states allocate their electoral votes. And Now, there's a reason why the Republicans are doing this. I mean, other than the reason that they want to win and they no longer have a majority pretty much anywhere. And that reason tracks back to Thomas Hobbes and John Locke and the whole concept of the Enlightenment and the concept of the actual nature of humans. And I'm going to get into that after the break. In a little more depth, because I think it's worth discussing. And it's also the rationale that the Republicans use to basically say that they can do anything. They can rig elections, they can you know, make sure that people in some districts stand in line 10 hours to vote, and other people stand in line 10 minutes to vote. All of these things in their mind are good and right because the means justifies the end. I'll explain when we come back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. How do the Republicans rationalize, or conservatives in large part, rationalize stealing elections, rigging elections? Okay, welcome back. Let me just lay this out for you. It's pretty straightforward stuff, actually. Back in the 1600s, Thomas Hobbes wrote a book called Leviathan, which became the foundation for both the modern conservative and the modern liberal movement. The modern liberal movement, in as much as in Leviathan, Hobbes made the wild speculation that possibly people could govern themselves. Although he didn't push for it. That you know, didn't come until almost 100 years later. But he also made the what is the basis of the modern conservative argument, and that is that the natural state of man, and by man we mean humankind, but you know, back then it was referred to as man or mankind, the natural state of people is not to be wise or thoughtful or empathetic or insightful or any of the things that we actually normally associate with humanness, but rather to be brutes. That's our natural state, according to Hobbes. And this is the foundation of the conservative worldview. And when you understand this, then all this stuff about why would the Republicans try to rig the elections in Virginia and in Wisconsin and in Michigan and in Ohio, why would they do this rather than simply going with the will of the people? I mean, isn't the will of the people what our Democratic Republic is supposed to be all about? Well, in their point of view, no. Hobbes wrote that, you know, lacking the iron fist of church or state, in such condition, that is, in the natural state of man, there is no place for industry because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, no use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious buildings, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Now, keep in mind, this was in the early 1600s that he wrote this. By the late 1600s, the 1670s, John Locke had taken that a step beyond that and said, no, life, you know, that we should have the rights of life, liberty, and private property, which is a radical notion because at that time the king owned everything, including your underwear. I mean, literally, the king owned everything. So life, liberty, and private property. And then 100 years later, Thomas Jefferson, you know, the Enlightenment began in arguably in the late 1600s. Now we're in the late 1700s. The Enlightenment is coming to full flower. Thomas Jefferson says life, liberty, and they've got private property nailed down. So life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then Jefferson, after he had first written his booklet, basically, about how we could be good British subjects. I guess would be it was called The Summary View of the Rights of British Americans. He then wrote a, quote, draft of instructions in how a colony may secede, may remove itself from Great Britain. And this is from his autobiography, or his private diaries, actually. And I'm not sure if this has ever been published before. I found it, his autobiography was published in 1909, in 1909, 100 years after he left the White House, by the Thomas Jefferson Society, in this 20-volume set, which I read back in the late 90s, and used as the basis for my book, What Would Jefferson Do? So, it may be out there. You might be hearing this for the first time. Anyhow, he sent out this draft of instructions, and he says, he wrote, I set out for Williamsburg some days before that appointed for our meeting, but was taken ill of a dysentery on the road and unable to proceed. I sent on, therefore, to Williamsburg two copies of my draft, the one under cover of Peyton Randolph, who I knew would be the chair of the convention, the other to Patrick Henry. Whether Mr. Henry disapproved of the ground taken or was too lazy to read it, parenthesis, for he was the laziest man in reading I ever knew, close parenthesis, I never learned, but he communicated it to nobody. And then, you know, ultimately Jefferson, what came out of that was Jefferson writing this. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Now that is the Enlightenment view. That is the liberal worldview. That government derives its power from us. Government does what we say, what the majority of us want. And government is there to provide for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to provide a baseline for us, a ground on which we can communally stand. And this was the essence of Barack Obama's speech yesterday, President Obama's speech. So why would conservatives and Republicans feel justified in rigging elections? In setting up these onerous voter ID laws and redrawing congressional districts and then changing the way states assign electoral votes so that if a Republican runs for president, he's guaranteed of getting the seat, even if the majority of Americans vote for the Democrat. Just like right now in the House of Representatives, the Republicans control the majority of the seats, even though 1.5 million more Americans voted for Democrats for the House of Representatives than voted for Republicans. See, the outcome would be the same for the White House, with the so-called proportional representation that the Republicans are talking about. Why would they do this? Because they share Hobbes's worldview. They think that, you know, without the restraining force of church or state, without a ruling elite, which of course is them, the Republicans, without a ruling elite, it's just going to be the rabble. And life is going to be solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And so it is their obligation, it is their duty to save us, the rabble, to save us from ourselves. And bring their billionaires in and rule benevolently over the rest of us who haven't yet figured out what's going on. So when we come back, I'll have the latest on the shootings in Texas. Pick up your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Is this a new American Revolution moment? Not a bloody revolution, but a revolutionary moment in terms of how we think of ourselves. Exposing the con and conservative. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. So, do you get it? The core conservative worldview is that people are born evil, that humans are born evil. This ties in with the conservative Christian worldview as well, that, you know, for all our sinners and have fallen short of the glory of God. But it goes beyond that, that because Eve ate the apple, women committed the original sin, therefore we're all sinners. Oh, by the way, the latest on the shooting, apparently so far it's 3 people have been shot, and apparently this was a shootout. 2 armed individuals shooting at each other, and at least one of the people who was severely wounded was caught in the crossfire. Again, hey, you know, guns on campus, what could possibly go wrong? We'll find out again as time goes on, as the story continues to come in. But this also explains why for the last God only knows how many years you've been hearing Rush Limbaugh whine about liberal elites, professors who want to run the country or tell you how to live. This is called projection. Sigmund Freud came up with this idea. He called it projection. And what it is that we see ourselves in others. We project our motives onto other people. I remember when I was 7 years old, I had a kid in my second grade class accuse me of stealing his pencil box or something. It was some small thing. And he made it into a big deal, and the teacher got all involved, and the class got all involved, and I went home and crying. You know, just I felt miserable about it because I didn't steal it. And nobody would believe me. The kid the next day found it, by the way. And my dad said, and this kid was always accusing people of stealing things from him, by the way. And my dad said, well, this is, you know, now you know that he's a kid that you can't trust because he will steal things from you. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, people who think that everybody steals do so because they steal. And it was like 7 years old, one of those aha moments. People who think everybody are angry themselves. People who think everybody is loving are loving themselves. People who think everybody's forgiving are forgiving themselves. People who think everybody is unforgiving are unforgiving themselves. I mean, it's Freud called a projection. So conservatives who run around constantly saying that liberals want a liberal elite professors and legislators. Now, how you get to be an elite as being elected by the majority of the people, I don't understand. But this is how the conservative, because, you know, that would be kind of populism. But in any case, this is the conservative rant that these elites want to run things and tell you how you can be happy by giving you Social Security and Medicare. Right. So this is how conservatives justify rigging elections, knocking people off voting rolls, laws that say that if you've ever been arrested, you can't vote or convicted of a crime, even though you've served your sentence, your duty. It really actually, you know, I mentioned Christianity in passing, it actually reveals a bit of a schism within Christianity, because this has been one of the great debates in Christianity for a long, long time, is what is the essential nature of people? But I don't want to turn this into a theological discussion, but you'll see that this is at the core of a lot of the theological debates these days. And because basically what it is, it's a conservative worldview versus a liberal worldview. Dave in Cleveland, Ohio. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just want to say a couple of things here. What they did in Virginia and what they did in Pennsylvania, it's despicable. It's disgusting. I can't even express how I feel about it right now. In Pennsylvania, they submitted legislation that's going to do this proportional allocation of
electoral votes.
Yeah. And they're talking about doing it in Ohio as well.
And Michigan, I mean, and Wisconsin,
yeah,
and Indiana,
I mean, it's,
and Virginia.
Can this be put up as a referendum to stop it on a state level? Because, I mean, this is serious trouble.
Yeah. There is no way that I know of to stop this, which is why it's got to be that, you know, a couple of years back when the Koch brothers and their buddies hatched this scheme, they probably sat around giggling for a week.
How can something so wrong be legal? I don't understand that. I mean, it's horrendous.
The Constitution says that the states can pick their electors any way they want. Now, you know, we've had some very bizarre things in our past. There have been states that pick their electors based on, you know, on basically bribery. In fact, for a long, long time, we used to pick senators that way. States used to pick senators until the 19-teens, I think it was, that we got direct election of senators. And you know, famously, in several states, in California and Montana, senators were various United States senators were famous for having in the case of the guy who represented the Copper Kings, I forget the name of the family, but it became the Anaconda Mines. You know, the guy stood outside the hall of the Senate, the state Senate, because the state senators selected the United States senator, with envelopes with $1,000 in each envelope, and just passed them out to people as they came out in exchange for their votes, and did it publicly. I mean, everybody knew it. And this kind of led to the outrage that led to the direct election of the United States Senate. But
well, we need to get on this now, because they're going to do it.
Yeah, no, they absolutely are going to do it. And the one way to counter this is to have all the blue states do the same thing. In other words, now these are almost all blue states that are under red control, but there actually has been a national proportional vote movement, and once enough states have signed up that it would have been 274, I guess it is, 271 electoral votes, then all these states have agreed in advance that they would, you know, count their votes basically by congressional districts, or the entire state would go for whoever got the majority vote. But it's like those were done in good faith as a rational way of trying to make sure that we never had the problem again of the majority of Americans voting for person A, like Al Gore got, you know, 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush did. And you know, people look at that and go, wait a minute, that's wrong. And, you know, well, the way it's going to be in 2016, if the Republicans have their way, is that it could be that, you know, Marco Rubio gets 5 million more votes than Hillary Clinton, or fewer votes rather than Hillary Clinton, but he becomes president anyway. So I guess all we can, you know, the main thing that we need to do right now, Dave, is what Paul Revere did, and that is spread the word. Tell people about what's going on and share your outrage, particularly with your federally elected officials, but also get involved in state politics and state party politics. Get involved. Show up. Dave, thank you for the call. Kevin in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Kevin.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you just fine.
Can I put it on talk?
Yeah. No, no, it's fine. Hello? Kevin? I can't hear you now. I think you tried to make things better, and instead you vanished. Jack in Brookings, Oregon. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I may have called a couple years ago. I can't remember for sure. I'm getting too old. But the way we could stop the Republicans from gerrymandering, redistricting, is I think they go into a district or an area and look to see who is registered Republican, how many are registered Democrat, and then they make the district so where they have more registered Republicans in that district. And that's what I understand is gerrymandering.
That's how they used to do it. It's gotten much more sophisticated than that over the last decade. Now they've got these massive computer programs. The one of the biggest ones is funded by the Koch brothers, and they look at income, at race, at whether people go to church. They look at all the variables that indicate whether a person could be motivated to go to the polls and vote for a Republican, and or could be motivated to go to the polls and vote for a Democrat. And so they're not just looking at the actuality of who's registered to vote. They're looking at the potential of who could be registered to vote as well now. It's gotten very, very sophisticated.
Well, my remedy, see, I am a progressive. I've been a registered Republican for about 8 years. Once I figured out that the primaries don't matter to me all that much, but it's the general election that matters, and nobody knows who I'm voting, whether I'm registered Republican, independent, or Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
But what I believe my registering as a Republican when I'm actually a Democrat is throwing them off a little.
Yeah.
Or is there gerrymandering?
Well, you will get also you will get fascinating access to information about what they're up to. I mean, this is why I gave $5 to John McCain's campaign.
Mm-hmm. I get mailings from the Republicans all the time.
Oh yeah,
I know everything they're doing.
Yeah, it's a useful thing, you know, once a year to give $5 to the RNC because they will spend $35 sending you stuff, you know, if nothing else, it's entertaining. I mean, as a talk show host, I feel like it's kind of my job. Jack, thanks for the call. And the old monkey wrench in the machine strategy. I can't endorse it, but I can't endorse it, but I admire it, shall we say. It's not quite the right word, but in any case, we'll be back in just a second. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And are the Republicans going to get away with this in Virginia? We don't know yet, but it looks like they probably are. Could bring up the date on that, too. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program. Kevin in Santa Rosa, California. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind?
Hi. We'll try this again. I just calling about the propositions we passed in 2008 and 2010 and 2012
mm-hmm.
that formed a California Redistricting Commission,
right,
which consists of five Democrats, five Republicans, and four of neither party. And because of that, we had a number of races where incumbents were pitted against each other.
Right.
And this, I think, is responsible for getting a two-thirds majority in both houses in the state assembly and Senate.
Right, which is why Jerry Brown could balance the budget. That and Proposition, whatever it was, 30, I think it was.
Right. And I think it helped get Dan Lundgren out of office.
Yep. And this is
because suddenly we had 2% more Democrats in that district?
Yeah, the magic word is polygons. There should be a federal law passed that says that all congressional districts have to be polygons, have to have roughly equal sides and all, shape. You know, it could be a square, it can be a circle, it could be an octagon, a hexagon, or whatever. But no more of this salamander shaped stuff. You know, no more of this gerrymandering, and no more picking winners and losers in advance of the elections, basically rigging the elections in advance, which is what, frankly, both parties have been doing for a long, long time. But the Republicans have now turned into a science, and they are using this science aggressively against small D democracy because, as I pointed out, they believe that they are the ones selected by God to lead us. Thank you, Kevin, for the call. And this is where Calvinism comes in. How do you know? You know, if you believe that people are fundamentally evil and that a small elect should lead us, the good people, how do you know who the good people are? Well, you look around and say, who did God pick to be happy? It must be the rich people. And so the rich people are the ones who should lead us. And they certainly agree with that. You know, as John Kenneth Galbraith said, the modern conservative is engaged in one of man's oldest exercises in moral philosophy, that is, the search for the superior moral justification for selfishness. And that's what we have. Will in Blakesley, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will.
Hey, Will. Tom, I'm sorry. This thing that you're talking about, and I'm so glad you're talking about this. This is just too important to even put words on. I'm from PA, as you know, and they're going to get this done in PA. It's a done deal. I've been talking to some of the Democratic representatives and a couple of the senators I know, and they said that there's really no way to stop it.
Yep.
But the bottom line is that this is obviously a silent coup, right?
Yes.
It really is, by the GOP right-wing extreme. I can't get, I think, and I know it's just wishful thinking, but I think that this is really truly an all hands on deck kind of thing. And the Democrats, I know that, you know, it's herding cats and all that, but they almost need to drop everything else they're doing, and they somehow have to get coordinated and just blast and shame the hell out of the Republicans that are doing this by call after call after call, harass them, call them.
Well, I think, in addition to that, I would submit that Democrats also need to be working for a national popular vote for the president.
Okay.
If the sword that the Republicans are going to wield is the Electoral College, then let's take that sword out of their hands.
Yeah, right. That would be great. That's the best. That's the ultimate solution, of course. I don't know how long it would take to get that done. But
there's already a whole bunch of states that have signed on to that. I'm gonna hit the DuckDuckGo machine here during the break and track down the information on it. A lot of this has been done. A lot of this, many states have already signed on with the national popular vote. This idea that once we know who got the national. The national election, then we'll throw our electoral college votes that way so that the electoral college always follows the actual vote rather than sometimes diverging from it. I mean, that's the whole goal of the thing.
Right. That'd be great. Yeah.
So that would be my next step. Anyhow, Will, thanks a lot for the call. I'm absolutely with you. Catherine in Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, Catherine.
Hi. Well, we have a graduate course in all of this here. And frankly, I think you're giving the Republicans, particularly here in Wisconsin, in the legislature, much too much credit for being intellectual at all. I mean, it's the Koch brothers that believe that philosophy and know the history, not them individually.
Oh, yeah, they've just bought off these politicians.
Well, yeah, they bought off. They're millionaires in office, out of office, and that's what it's about.
Yep.
It's just horrendous. I mean, this is a civil war. States' rights was just code word for continuing the civil war.
Yes.
And now they've refined it. I haven't read it yet, but I heard on Marshall McLuhan's, the anniversary of his birth or death, that some of the last stuff he was writing was on the information war.
Hmm.
And I think he thought all physical war would go rather than it working on a parallel plane.
Yeah. Well, let me just very quickly tell you a story. I walked through a conservative think tank, and I don't want to name them because it would be inappropriate, but I walked through a conservative think tank here in Washington, D.C. about 5 years ago. And I was getting a tour from a friend who worked there, and we walked through a room that had all these little cubbies, these cubicles, and maybe 40 or 50 people working in cubbies, maybe 25 or 35 even. I might be exaggerating slightly, but they were all young people. They looked like they were interns, and they all had computer screens, and every single one of their computer screens in front of them had Wikipedia on it.
They change things.
And you wonder why, you know, you read Wikipedia and it basically says, you know, Smoot Hawley led to the Great Depression. Well, no, it didn't. But, you know, I could give you a thousand, you know, just a thousand examples of how Wikipedia has been basically rewritten by right-wingers. And, you know, it's like there's a method to their madness. They're very methodical about it.
This is war. Have you heard about the documentary As Goes Janesville?
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, long story short, it was about Walker. Walker was having this vanity piece done on him, and he didn't understand that people were going to revolt, so it started in January before the February occupation. And so Diane Hendricks is the 415th richest woman in the United States, a billionaire, and she's in bed with the Koch. She literally goes to the secret meetings, and in the beginning of this film, you can hear her say to him, "Do you think we're going to be a one-party state, a right-to-work state? What can we do to help?"
Right, and that's where he said he's going to go after the public workers first and then pit them against the private workers, unions, right?
You have it on film.
Yeah, I remember when that came out. Catherine, thank you. Yes, yeah, I think you're right. It is a war. It's not a war where anybody's going to be pulling a gun, but it is becoming basically a trench warfare. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. We have arguably gone back and forth, back and forth, back and forth in the United States between being a more conservative country, shall we say, and a more liberal country. Now, those words in the last hour, I was talking about those words in the context of Hobbes and Locke and Jefferson and Rousseau. In a way, you could use those frames. But, for example, from Teddy Roosevelt until 1920, we had a very activist government. It was actively breaking up big companies and working for the benefit of small business people and taxing at the top rate of 95%. Millionaires and what today we would call billionaires, and corporations were providing almost 40% of all the total revenues into the federal government. In the election of 1920, Warren Harding ran on the campaign promise of less government in business, more business in government. That was his slogan, one of his two slogans. And he delivered on that. He dropped the top tax rate down to 25%. He dropped the corporate tax rate, kicked off the roaring 20s, which then led to the great crash of 1929. And then we became a more liberal country. So we had this conservative era and then this liberal era, which arguably was the FDR, followed by Truman, followed by Eisenhower, followed by Kennedy, followed by Lyndon Johnson. Actually, the more liberal era, the era of Social Security and Medicare and unemployment benefits and minimum wage and workplace protections, went from FDR's presidency in 1932 up until Ronald Reagan's presidency in 1980. And then we flip back to the more Warren Harding kind of conservative. Well, those are really not the jobs of government. Those are not the roles of government. Let's get government out of the business education. Let's privatize our schools. Let's get business out of our government out of the, you know, out of meddling in workplace issues. It shouldn't be backstopping unions, all these kinds of things. And so we had the Reagan Revolution in a very real sense of revolution. Charles Krauthammer was positing on Fox News yesterday that Obama's, not his election, but his re-election, that the speech that he gave yesterday was basically a declaration that the era of Reagan was over, much like FDR in 1933 said that the era of Warren Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover was over, that that era was over, and that we were coming back into a new progressive era, not unlike that of the FDR and Truman and Eisenhower administrations. Here is Charles Krauthammer on Fox News.
And I think what's most interesting is that Obama basically is declaring the end of Reaganism in this speech. Remember, he once said that Ronald Reagan was historically consequential in a way that Bill Clinton was not. And what Obama meant is that Obama had changed the ideological course of the country.
The Reagan.
In 1981, in his inaugural address, within 2 minutes, Reagan had declared that government is not the solution, government is the problem. Today's inaugural address was a rebuke to that entire idea. This speech today was an ode to big government. It was a hymn to big government.
And I absolutely agree with Charles Krauthammer. Jamie Weinstein is on the line with us. He is the senior editor of the Daily Caller, dailycaller.com, the website. Hey, Jamie.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Fine. Good to see you again. You're a conservative. I'm a liberal, whatever kind of labels we want to put on it. Do we agree that this transition is happening right now?
Well, I think what Krauthammer was saying is astute and right. I'm not sure he's saying that it's definitive, that this is what we're going to have. That's clearly, I think, what Obama signaled he wants to call for. And if that does, in fact, occur and that the Obama era lasts beyond his presidency, maybe historians will look back and say, well, this was the moment that was kind of the declaration. I still think that there's a potential that, that this era doesn't last particularly long. But certainly I think yesterday's speech was a declaration by President Obama that this is the end of Reaganism and the return of big government.
You know, every time we've tried shrinking government and thus expanding the role of billionaires in our civil society, because it really one balances the other, right? I mean, organized money versus organized people or politics. Every time we've tried that, the results have been disastrous. After Reconstruction in the early 1880s, you could argue starting with the Ulysses S. Grant administration, we had the longest depression in the entire history and the deepest in the entire history of the United States. It was worse than the Great Depression in the 1930s. And then it was progressives that pulled us out of that in the 1900s, you know, in 1900, after the assassination of McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt, the progressive. And in fact, you could even argue that Taft, you know, who followed him, a Republican president, was a progressive. And then, you know, we went back into this conservative era and boom, we got the Great Depression. And then we came out of that and we had 40 years of prosperity. Eisenhower was clearly a progressive. Nixon was a progressive by these standards. And then we came into Reaganomics and we said, okay, let's try it again for the third time. Let's see, you know, maybe third time is the charm. Get government out of the way. And what's happened in the 32 years since Reagan was inaugurated, average working people's wages have gone up less than a dollar in inflation adjusted dollars. And the top 1% has seen their wealth go up 275%. We've gone from a nation that used to make things to a nation that buys things from China. We have impoverished ourselves.
I mean, I think that's obviously your interpretation of things.
Yeah, clearly.
In 1980, when Reagan was elected, 1981, when he was inaugurated, this was Jimmy Carter era, the malaise speech, which he actually never used the word malaise, but was the time that, you know, we're going to have to understand that America is, you know, declining in the world, basically.
Jimmy Carter never said that.
That was the distinct impression.
That was the conservative spin on it.
There's little question that we had to accept kind of a new state of affairs for the world. Reagan brought back hope and reinvigorated the economy, where our GDP was unleashed over that time. So much so that he changed the paradigm that Bill Clinton in his 1996 State of the Union speech basically echoed Reagan and said the era of big government is over.
I agree with you.
And this was
Clinton was following Reaganomics. Clinton did not reverse Reaganomics.
Well, this was a time of great prosperity and wealth creation in the United States.
Well, wasn't it a bubble?
I don't think it was a bubble.
We got a 32-year period where the average working person has gotten screwed and the rich have gotten really, really rich. How is that not a bubble?
Well, first of all, those two things don't necessarily go together, right?
Actually, in history, they usually do.
If your numbers are right, just because the rich get richer doesn't mean the poor are supposedly being marginalized and we're on a bubble.
But that's what's happened.
I don't think the numbers you're taking into account, the entitlement programs and the increased benefits that go along there. But there's no question that there has been somewhat of a disparity between the rich and the rest. But still,
we were the most socially mobile and economically mobile nation in the world.
When Reagan came
today, we are the least socially and economically mobile nation of the 34 most developed nations.
When Reagan came into office, we were in economic decline. The United States was not in good shape. Reagan.
We were doing just fine. We had an inflation problem as a result of the Vietnam War bills being paid off.
Tom, you really think that we were in great economic times when Reagan?
Yeah, I was running businesses during that time, Jamie. I'm a little older than you. I remember it well. I made a lot of money during that period of time.
I know a lot of people who are running businesses during that time. They don't recall that era as particularly a time of great prosperity.
It was expensive to get a mortgage. I'll tell you that.
Yes. Well, there is very few people, I think, that will take that interpretation, Tom, that the time of the end of the Carter era were great time economically. Reagan came in. He kind of reinvigorated both the American spirit.
He borrowed $3 trillion, and he did it with Keynesian economics, Jamie. He borrowed $3 trillion and spent it to goose the economy.
Our GDP roared, Tom. And it was certainly not through purely Keynesian means. Milton Friedman was one of his big backers.
All right. I will leave you with the last word. Now, Jamie Weinstein, the Daily Caller, dailycaller.com is the website. It's fascinating that we agree on this pivot point in any case. Jamie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you think? Are we at a turning point in history? And if so, how are the Republicans going to react to it? 20 minutes past the hour. We will see. Oh, the filibuster, by the way. Harry Reid, today was supposed to be the day when Harry Reid would decide whether they were going to do what Democrats refer to as the constitutional option and Republicans refer to as the nuclear option, which is say we're going to change the rules by which the Senate operates on the first day that the Senate is in session. And we're going to change the filibuster so that senators who want to gum up the works, who want to block legislation, have to stand on the floor and talk in order to do it. The old Mr. Smith goes to Washington, Jimmy Stewart thing. And this has been suggested by Jeff Merkley and Tom Udall and Elizabeth Warren, and now Tammy Baldwin has signed on for it, and a number of other senators are, you know, right there with that. Harry Reid had said to a number of us over the previous months that he was inclined to go in that direction. He's now talking about, well, maybe there's something just short of that that would make it more difficult to filibuster, but would still give the Republicans an opportunity to block legislation if they were really passionate about it. And now he's talking about, well, maybe I can work out something with my good friend Mitch McConnell. We will see. You know, Mitch McConnell apparently he'd been playing Reid along, going, let's talk, I'll talk with you. But today, McConnell, when Reid said that he was not going to adjourn the Senate for the day, in other words, the first day of this Senate was actually, you know, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, but he never adjourned it. And so we're still in that first day. And tonight he's not going to adjourn it. So we'll still be in that first day tomorrow. And the day after tomorrow, he's not going to adjourn it. Tomorrow he's not going to adjourn it. So we will still be in that first day the day after. So he can still change the rules. They want to do the Hurricane Sandy relief thing first. And then they're going to change the rules. And he's going to, and Harry Reid has come out and said he's seriously thinking of doing this 51 vote thing. And his caucus, the Democrats, are with him on 51 votes for changing the filibuster. It's just, what kind of change? Is it the Carl Levin, John McCain change? Or is it the Udall and Merkley change and Elizabeth Warren, which, of course, obviously is the one I support? And we shall see. I was expecting that today was going to be the day that he was going to I hate to use gun metaphors, pull the trigger on it. But apparently it's going to be a day or two. Speaking of gun metaphors, apparently now 3 shot in Texas in what was apparently a gunfight on the Lone Star College's campus, and initial reporting a gunfight over grades. Yep, let's have armed people on campus. The NRA told you, you know, the more people you've got with guns, an armed society is a polite society. You want to see really polite people? Go down to the morgue. They will not bother you at all. In any case, we have 3 people shot. One of them was apparently caught in the crossfire. And the story is still coming out. So, you know, beyond that, I'm not going to speculate. Other than just repeating the, hey, you know, guns on campus, what could possibly go wrong? Warren in New York City. Hey, Warren, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
I just wanted to take forward what you were coming to see today, which you hadn't seen on Friday, which is that the national, a popular vote interstate compact is the way to go.
Right.
But you know what I had thought when, you know, when all this despondent talk was coming out was that you could push that compact forward by doing an A-B comparison with what the Republicans are trying with this proportional electoral college thing.
Right.
Because if you go to the, and I'm just basing this on the Wikipedia site, although I've heard that it scares the right a lot. You look at the polling on this. This national popular vote movement is very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just, you know, it's like 78% support among Democrats, 60% support among Republicans, 73% among independents. I mean, this is, you know, this is something that could actually turn this Republican strategy into something they'll regret having ever tried.
I agree.
Look at the states where it's pending. It's pending in New York, it's pending in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
You throw in these other states, these north central states in Indiana and so forth. They push it over the top.
Yep. And this could be my thinking on this is that the think tanks, the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute, all these think tanks that the Koch brothers fund, that their plan was to basically put Republicans in control of a bunch of blue states, blue swing states, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida, and then try to, once they had control of those states, redistrict them like crazy so that they had lots and lots and lots of solid red seats, red upside down star Republican congressional seats, and then go ahead and say, you know, in these states, we're going to reallocate our electoral votes, and so they no longer are swing states. And they figured that they would have this done before anybody figured it out, because they've done so much of this stuff before anybody figured it out. Look at all the states that have voter ID laws, voter suppression ID laws. And, you know, without any debate, nobody even knew what was going on. Look at Michigan with the law that says that Governor Rick Snyder can just, you know, go into a Democratic community. I mean, small d, a community where the government was elected by the people. It may be a Republican government, but it was elected by the people. And he can simply say, sorry, I know you were elected, but you're not in charge anymore. I'm putting one of my buddies in charge here. And he can sell off your city. He can sell off your public, as in the case of Benton Harbor, they sold off the water, you know, a park along Lake Michigan to a golf course that had been coveting it for years and years. And,
but they
were able to get away with this stuff because nobody was speaking out. But now we've got a good, strong infrastructure, progressive infrastructure on the Internet, on radio and on television. And I think that they can't get away with this stuff the way they thought they could. Warren?
Backfire. That's what we learned.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I mean, they did overreach and they did sort of lose the last election, but they held the House. So we'll see. But I am hopeful that they've overreached, and I'm hopeful that this will move for a national popular vote. Thank you, Warren.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Reaganomics. Jimmy Carter, I thought, was a damn good president. I'll just have to say that for the record. Oh, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very contumeliously ugly, contumeliously. Boy, we really worked on that one, Shano and me, and I don't think we ever got it right. Close enough. Anyhow, the good. President Obama. Yesterday, President Obama specifically mentioned climate change in his inaugural speech and the need to fight it. Well, it appears that fighting climate change may, in fact, be a top priority for Obama's second term. Heather Zeichal, deputy assistant to the president for energy and climate change, told the Hill newspaper last night that, quote, we are going to achieve the president's goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 17% by 2020. I am not going to get in front of my boss on this one. I think you will in due time see a really aggressive agenda on the energy and climate initiative in line with what the president talked about today, end quote. Let's hope this isn't just politics as usual and that the president, in fact, does tackle climate change in the next 4 years. With a growing number of Americans realizing that climate change is real and here to stay, it's time the White House did more to prevent a complete environmental catastrophe. The bad, Phil Mickelson. Mickelson is one of the top golfers in the world, worth an estimated $180 million, according to Forbes. He earns more than $30 million a year just from endorsements, made over $10 million in winnings from tournaments last year. But apparently this enormous wealth isn't enough because Mickelson is complaining about the burden of taxes in California. In fact, Mickelson finds the taxes so burdensome that he's considering moving out of the Golden State. He told CBS Sportsline that, quote, "There are going to be some drastic changes for me because I happen to be in that zone that has been targeted both federally and by the state, and you know, it doesn't work for me right now," end quote. Or, in other words, like the majority of the wealthy elite in America, Mickelson doesn't want to do his fair share to help the economy and the nation. And the very, very ugly South Carolina State Senator Lee Bright. In the wake of the Newtown tragedy, numerous states have introduced laws to allow teachers and school officials to carry guns. But in South Carolina, State Senator Lee Bright, a Republican, is taking it a step farther. He has introduced a bill that would create a gun shooting class at South Carolina schools. The class, which would be known as the South Carolina Gun Safety Program, would teach proper use of a firearm and safety techniques, among other things. Speaking about the law, Bright said, quote, "You got football, you got baseball, you got basketball. I think if they had a hunting team, it would be a great idea." Apparently, Mr. Bright thinks putting guns in what is supposed to be a safe learning environment is a very good idea. And that is very, very ugly. By the way, reports out of Texas, Lone Star University, three people shot in a gunfight between two people, apparently over grades. Yes, armed people on college campuses. What could possibly go wrong? Carl in Boise, Idaho. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, I was just thinking about, you know, the armed camp that we've got in our schools now with that shooting today. Something that just kind of clicked in my head was the use of these scanners, you know, airport scanners. And so they're great just to go down to the courthouse. I've got to go through basically, you know, a big pat down and go through scanners.
Yeah, it's just like airport security.
Yeah, and just this is just going to the courthouse and maybe you know, do a little legal work. But it hit me, you know, one of the driving forces of this recent notion of everybody packing, you know, heat. There's a financial incentive. I don't know if you know, but there would be for people manufacturing scanners, for crying out loud.
Oh my! You know, so this is like the theory that the people who sell the solutions to the computer viruses are the ones who are creating the viruses in the back room.
Yeah, I won't go to to the level of a conspiracy, but I will say that you know, down the road we could see an awful lot of scanners everywhere.
Yeah. You know, Carl, if it wasn't for the fact that back in the 70s, I had this friend, his name was Stanley, and he was a chemist. He had a chemistry major in college. I'm not even sure he ever graduated from college, because when he was going to college, he started making these little drug testing kits that he was selling in the back of High Times magazine in the classified ads. And this was like 1973. And you could use these kits to find out how strong the pot was that you were buying, or whether the cocaine that you were scoring was actually pure cocaine or not, or whatever, you know. And you know, he sold them for $5 or whatever it was. And he made a really good living selling these things. And then, you know, the Nixon drug laws came along and the whole war on drugs, and all of a sudden drug testing boomed. And Stanley sold his business for, I've told this story many times on the air, my recollection, and I may be wrong, you know, it's been a lot of years, but my recollection is that Stanley made $300 million selling that company. And the drug testing industry now is a multi-billion-dollar industry. And that's just testing for them. That doesn't include the multi-billion-dollar industry associated with law enforcement, and then the multi-billion-dollar private prison industry, and then the multi-billion-dollar or probably at least $1 billion a year, criminal defense industry and prosecution industry. I mean, there's all kinds of people making money on the war on drugs. And I'll bet you're absolutely right that there's all kinds of people making money on the fact that, you know, we're scared to death that somebody's going to shoot up our schools. And, so, you know, I'm generally not somebody that people would characterize as a conspiracy theorist, but Carl, that makes sense to me. Thanks a lot for the call. Carmen in Hamilton, Montana. Hey, Carmen.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Well, I feel like there's a whole lot of psyops being played on this country, if you know what that stuff is.
Yeah, psychological operations.
Yeah, well, we've got to look at that all the time, because we don't hear these wimpy chicken hawk Republicans beating the war drums right now, but they're all crying about the guns because they can't clip back to back 30-round banana clips together. Have about 8 or 10 together, you know, and have about 240 rounds on you. You know, if you're a hunter, if you can't shoot with one or two shots to get a deer, you shouldn't be a hunter. I think they should test these people. They should test everybody that wants to carry a gun.
Well,
there's a lot of people that shouldn't have guns.
Yeah, well, by and large, most states regulate hunters, and most hunters are just fine with that because they are sportsmen and women. And, you know, so, you know, you got to have a duck plug in your gun. You can't have more than 3 rounds available to you, you know, with the shotgun that you're hunting ducks with. And, you know, certain types of ammunition are allowed and not allowed, and certain types of rifles are allowed and not allowed during deer hunting season or moose hunting season or bear hunting season. You know, and they vary depending on the species that you're going after. If you're hunting rabbits, it's a whole different set of rules than something else. And you know, most hunters kind of go along with that. So, yeah, makes a certain amount of sense, Carmen. Thanks a lot for the call. Rick in Buena Park, California. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tom. I just want to first thank you so much for educating me every day. I've read 3 of your books and I'm a big fan. But the reason I'm calling is because of the gerrymandering all these Republicans are doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just don't know if I heard it on your show, but something about if the federal elections get redone and say if it has to do with the federal election, that district has to be done by a third-party, unpartisan body, would that be possible, or what kind of solutions can we do?
Well, that's what California did. The voters of California got together and passed a ballot initiative that said, you know, we don't want the politicians drawing the districts anymore. We want bipartisan and nonpartisan commissions doing it. And arguably that's been very, very useful for the political process in California. And if it wasn't for the fact that the Constitution explicitly says that states can basically figure out how they want to assign electors themselves and draw congressional districts, it would, in theory, be possible to pass federal legislation that would say, you know, this is going to be done by nonpartisan commissions. These are the kinds of moments when you want those nameless, faceless bureaucrats with the green eye shades who work for the government and all they want to do is, you know, make their $40,000 a year for 40 years and at the end of 40 years retire with a pension, and they don't give a rat's patootie about Republicans or Democrats. They are bureaucrats. These are the people that you would like, you know, actually drawing these districts based on just rational things like how many people, you know, okay, we've got 6 million people in the state. We got 6 districts. Let's have a million here, a million here, a million here, and without giving consideration to where are the Republicans and where are the Democrats. But, you know, right now, I don't think it would be constitutional to do that at a federal level. It is, however, legal and constitutional to do it at a state level.
So what other avenues do you think might be possible? Because I don't see any way that we're ever going to be able to wrestle the House away from them. And then they're doing this where they're going to, you know, spread out the electoral votes, you know, by district. And I just think that I'm very pessimistic about our options here.
Yeah. And the Constitution specifies that every 10 years, every year that ends in a zero, is the year that there will be a census of the population, and then congressional districts will be redrawn based on that census. And so the last time it happened was in 2010. Before that, it was 2000. The next time it's going to happen is 2020. So I'd say 2 things. One, get ready for 2020. And because the Republicans were getting ready for 2010 back in 2000. Shano pointed out to me, and I think he's right, that in the 2000 election in Bush v. Gore, when the Supreme Court said that you and I, the people have no enumerated right in the Constitution to vote for president of the United States, at that point, the Koch brothers went, oh, really? And, you know, so how can we rig the game? You know, and that led right to 2010. They were ready for 2010. We need to get ready for 2020. And frankly, in addition to trying to beat them at their own game, I would like to see us try to create a new game where there isn't a winner and a loser, but rather everybody just understands it's an honest game, and so it can go on and on and on, unlike Monopoly, where at the very end of the game, one person has everything and everybody else is broke, which is sort of, you know, how capitalism works these days increasingly. Rick, thanks for the call. And if you want to see these things happen, by the way, this is the kind of stuff that happens when people who care show up at their local Democratic Party or Republican Party, for that matter, and say, I would like to volunteer. I want to be a precinct committee person. I want to participate. And you can do that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Latest is still three shot on a college campus in a dispute over grades. Armed people on campus, what could go wrong? Welcome back to your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave and get a photo of your slave and the goat. And maybe Ellen Ratner will be in the picture because she's over there three or four times a year. She put the thing together, GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, on the line with us. Victoria, what's going on in the world? I understand that the old what could possibly go wrong, guns on campus, has come full circle.
Guns on campus has come full circle once again. This on a campus, by the way, the Lone Star College in North Houston, Texas, that employs armed police officers and unarmed security guards. At least three people were shot in a shooting at Lone Star College in North Houston today, sometime before 12:30 p.m. It's believed that one of the shooters is in custody, injured. One of them, they are looking for. The shooting may have escalated after a heated argument, possibly over a bad grade. At least two victims were caught in the crossfire and suffered multiple gunshot wounds. One of the victims is a school employee. Now, 5 days ago, Texas Senator Brian Birdwell, Republican, and 13 other Republican authors introduced legislation that would allow individuals with concealed weapon permits to carry firearms on campus. The measure failed in the last legislative session, but is now up for debate in the aftermath of the shooting in Newtown, Connecticut.
So how did these guns get on this campus if the campus did not allow people with carry permits?
Somebody brought them on illegally.
Aha, okay.
Yeah.
But my understanding is this was a gunfight, that both parties were armed, shooting
right
at each other. So two people had to bring them on illegally.
Shooting at each other. People got caught in the crossfire.
Was this like Hamilton and Burr, you know? I'll meet you at noon.
I don't know. I mean, apparently it was over a bad grade, which sounds odd. I think there is a lot we don't yet know about this.
Dueling at high noon in front of the English class, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very weird.
What else? By the way, I'm also seeing, I was on the BBC site during the last break, and they're reporting that Bibi Netanyahu doesn't look like he's polling so well in Israel, that the center-left parties seem to be polling.
He's not polling so well. He has won. Hmm. But as I reported in my newsletter this morning, he comes back weakened.
Hmm.
And will have to forge a coalition, and you usually have coalition governments in Israel,
right,
with either the center and center-left parties, or he will have to forge a coalition with the far-right party, which is led by a rather charismatic leader who has gained quite a lot of traction, or with some other small far-right parties.
Mm.
And it would be easier for him to form a coalition with the far-right parties, but harder for him to govern with them. The pro-settler Jewish Home Party, his charismatic leader is Naftali Bennett.
Right.
He opposes a Palestinian state and supports the annexation of most of the West Bank. I had an interview with him today on the BBC, and he was being asked about peace with the Palestinians and what to do, and well, what should they do, and they believed it was home. And he said, well, there are 22 Arab nations.
Hmm. What does that mean?
it means there are other places they can go.
Oh, I see. I see. And there's only one Jewish state.
Right.
In other words, yeah, okay.
Right. But it would be difficult for him to govern with the far-right coalition, but easier to form a coalition. So it'll be interesting to see what he's going to do. He's going to have to do something. I mean, it was a very moribund campaign. It was on domestic issues. The economy's in a bit of a tank. They really didn't campaign on Palestine. They really didn't campaign on Iran. He ran on being a strong leader. The word Hazak, I believe it is, for strong, was in all the ads, and that's how he ran. I'm strong.
Yeah.
Vote for me.
Yeah. Hm.
And it worked.
So what else is going on?
Because the three center-left parties argued among themselves about whether they should get together in a coalition to oppose him.
Right.
It was pathetic.
Well, and also they didn't have a charismatic leader, and Bibi Netanyahu is a fairly charismatic guy.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
He's very likable.
He is likable.
So what else is going on in the world?
Well, other things going on. The House will vote tomorrow to raise the debt ceiling for 3 months. Will it pass? Probably. It's probably going to get some Democratic votes. The White House gave it an imprimatur today. Jay Carney, the press secretary, calling it significant. Certainly something we welcome. And the Conservative Club for Growth also said it won't score against it. So probably will pass.
Hmm.
Also today, the Supreme Court refused to consider reducing the Environmental Protection Agency's authority to set air quality standards, leaving intact a tough new limit on sulfur dioxide emissions in a victory for the Obama administration.
Wow, that's great.
So
well,
that's
this, you know, Nixon's EPA was actually designed to do things like cleaning up sulfur dioxide. In fact, it was George Herbert Walker Bush who got cap and trade passed to deal with sulfur dioxide, and it was quite successful.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Also today, Nebraska governor wrote to the president and the secretary of Clinton saying that he has okayed a revised route for the Keystone XL pipeline. And of course, he was a big hiccup to the Keystone XL. So with him okaying it, it's now down to the State Department and Hillary Clinton, the secretary, and their review of Keystone XL. And their decision is expected by March the 31st, although there are some people saying it may get pushed back. This is really the first test of President Obama on climate change, which he championed in his inaugural yesterday.
And yet they're building. I mean, we had Daryl Hannah on the show along with a rancher, a woman whose ranch had been in her family for centuries down in Texas, or a century anyway. And they're already taking her ranch by eminent domain, and they're building the pipeline through it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So I think it's a done deal. It's just a matter of acknowledging it. But we'll see. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, goodsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Always great talking to you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. We've been talking throughout the day about the hiccups and oddities and strangenesses and outright in Virginia corruption of our electoral process. One of the biggest pieces of that is money in our electoral process, and somebody who's doing something about it is the Attorney General for the great state of New York, Eric T. Schneiderman. Attorney General Schneiderman, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here. Thank you.
It is great to have you with us. I understand that you have figured out a way that you can do something about this so-called dark money, at least in the state of New York.
Yeah, we have, as I think a lot of people know, become aware. My office regulates nonprofits in New York State, and we become aware, as everyone nationally should be aware, that in the 2012 election cycle, people who wanted to conceal their identity as donors and conceal the expenditures on attack ads laundered about almost $500 million through 501c4 nonprofits. It's really an abuse, in my view, of the nonprofit form. These are supposed to be social welfare organizations. And it's a way, Citizens United was bad enough, But Citizens United at least required disclosure. In fact, that was one of the key arguments in the majority.
Yeah, there was an 8-1 ruling, as I recall, on the disclosure.
It was one of the most important arguments as to why the ruling was not going to destroy our notion of one equal justice under law and electoral equality. But this C4 loophole is the way people have avoided making such disclosures. So it's really amazing because even the super PACs and the PACs have to disclose who the donors are. Everyone knows Sheldon Adelson gave a lot of money to Newt Gingrich. The only reason for people to use nonprofits and abuse nonprofits is to conceal their identity. So that should make everyone very nervous. And I regulate nonprofits in New York State. So while I cannot control federal elections because that's under the control of the federal government, we have amended our regulations regulating nonprofits that to require that if they spend $10,000 on any electoral activity, we're going to make them itemize all expenditures and all donations in New York for our state and local elections. This cycle, and I hope to have the regulations finalized in the next month or so, this cycle we elect mayor of New York City, mayor of Buffalo, county executives across the state, probably going to have a statewide referendum on casino gambling. So I can't deal with the problem of federal elections, but I certainly can set a good example for the rest of the country, I hope, by requiring full disclosure. And, you know, my most important goal, of course, is to protect the voters and the people of the state of New York so that if someone's coming in here to spend millions of dollars on attack ads, they know who it is and they can evaluate it fairly.
Attorney General Schneiderman, my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that one of the rationales that these 501c4s have used is that because they're incorporated under a very 501c3, very similar to that provision of the IRS regulations with regard to nonprofits for educational, the same as a school would be, for example, a nonprofit school, that they're not actually running political ads. They're running educational ads. They're helping educate people about issues like the fact that a particular politician is, you know, a bad guy or whatever. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, you deal with it by showing it's not true. We have a nonprofit come into New York State and intervene in three state Senate elections, and none of the ads had anything to do with its stated purpose of educating the public about the benefits of small government and low taxes. It was all scurrilous personal attack ads. So the first step is to challenge that. But, you know, there are regulations deal with the issue simply by saying if you're doing direct political ads where you say vote for or against someone, that clearly has to be disclosed. And a lot of these C4s spend money on just such ads. And if you're spending money on what are supposed to be issue ads, but they name a candidate or an official and it's within 180 days of the election, you should disclose that too. Because a lot of these, you know, are very, you know, call Senator Smith and tell him to stop raising taxes on working families and cutting funds for education. You know, within 180 days of the election, we think people should know who's paying for that ad, too. I have jurisdiction over nonprofits spending money in New York State and raising money in New York State, and I think I'm confident our regulations will be challenged, but I'm also confident that we'll prevail in court. And we have to call attention to the fact that because of the inaction of the Internal Revenue Service, people are getting away with concealing their identity. And you have to wonder why people would want to conceal their identity. I mean, now under Citizens United, they're allowed to spend as much as they want in favor or opposition to a candidate. It's sort of like someone, if you're working in a bank and someone walks in wearing a mask, you should wonder what the heck they're up to. Mm-hmm. So people who want to hide their identity by pretending to be nonprofits, there's a reason for that, and I think we're going to find out a lot. We're going to find out a lot about exactly what's going on here once these regulations kick in and we force these folks to disclose.
Does New York State have anything analogous to the initiative process in California, for example?
We did not have initiatives, but we do have referendas, and we actually have one on the ballot. I'm pretty confident we'll have one on the ballot this year. Which is whether or not to legalize casino gambling, a big issue.
Will this cover that? Because there's not an individual associated with that.
No, with our regulations would cover expenditures on anything that is subject to the electoral process, elections for office or referendum that people vote on. So we would cover that as well. And again, you can just see the need for this and the simplicity of our arguments, if there are lots of ads being run in opposition to casino gambling, people ought to know if it's being paid for by casinos in neighboring states.
Because
they're against casino gambling, they just don't want competition. This is the kind of disclosure that is necessary in this post-Citizens United world when unlimited sums of money can be spent. This is our last line of protection for the voters, and we intend to really be pretty tough about enforcing that line and raising this issue with, as I have with my colleagues in other states and with my federal counterparts, because I look forward to federal action on this before long. This system can't stand.
Well, that was another question that came to mind is, and we're talking with the Attorney General of the State of New York, Eric Schneiderman, are you blazing a trail here? Will New York be the first state to do this, or are you following in the wake of somebody, and are you trying to make this a national issue? Are you hoping that people will pick up on this?
Well, we are the first state to do this, to move forward and require disclosure. My first goal is to protect New Yorkers, and the reason we're moving quickly on this and we're holding hearings around the state to get all the input that we think is appropriate and finalize the regs is because we want to get this in place before the local elections this year. We have a lot at stake in New York. New York City mayor, not an insignificant job. People should know who's spending money in support of or opposition to a candidate. But a secondary goal is, as you said, we are flagging this as a national issue. We're not alone in that. There are others who have raised this issue. A lot of good government groups have very aggressively been pursuing the Internal Revenue Service, filing rulemaking petitions. The IRS has refused to act. They have refused to address this issue. And an incomprehensible dereliction of duty, and I'm hopeful that this will increase the pressure on them. And I think some of our federal counterparts on Capitol Hill are looking at raising this issue.
We just have a half a minute left. Don't you think maybe the IRS is paralyzed because they're afraid of being perceived as being political?
Well, I think they give, they certainly have always pushed back giving that as an excuse. But you can't have $500,000 being laundered through organizations that under the Internal Revenue Code are supposed to be exclusively, and that word is used, social welfare organizations without the IRS intervening. So I think they will be forced to act at some point. And if we speed that process up through our work in New York, that's a good thing, too.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, thank you for the great work you're doing on behalf of your state. And let us hope that it echoes across the United States. Sir, thank you.
Thank you.
Great having you on. It's 15 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program. We'll be back with the latest update on the shootings in Texas and the election rigging in Virginia right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
Stick around. We'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the weapons of mass deception. And, a fine thing that A.G. Schneiderman is out there doing the same thing. He's doing his version. I always thought when Eliot Spitzer was the attorney general for the state of New York and he was going after the banksters, that he was a guy who could become the next FDR. He could become the next president of the United States. And I look at what Eric Schneiderman is doing and the courage this guy has. I almost used a colorful metaphor, but, the courage that he has to take on these interests. I mean, in New York, you're taking on big money in New York. You're taking on, well, this is, if you've seen the movie Client Number 9, which I recommend very highly, you see that Eliot Spitzer basically angered a billionaire by going after him, and the billionaire hired Roger Stone, this political consultant, to break the law and take down Spitzer. And they did it by breaking the law. And it's like you got to be squeaky clean. You got to have no skeletons in your closet, and you got to have incredible courage. And that is one hell of a tough job, and it's quite a CV to have to be able to stand up and do that and be that. And I just have to As I have to say, I have tremendous respect for Attorney General Schneiderman. I'll leave it at that. Glenn in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Glenn, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about gerrymandering?
I was under the impression that gerrymandering was illegal.
No, it's standard operating practice. There are states, for example, California, that have turned the process of drawing or redrawing districts every 10 years based on the census over to nonpartisan commissions. And there is, good government groups like Common Cause have been working nationwide to try and get that done in every state. But it's only a few states that have done it. Most states, it's a purely partisan process. And in those states that traditionally have, in presidential elections, gone blue, the Koch brothers and their buddies have poured enormous amounts of money into those states in the last decade to get red control of blue states so that when the 2010 census was done and the 2011 and 2012 redistricting was done, that they could have control of that process. And they did, and they used it to their advantage. So unfortunately, Glenn, no, it's not illegal. It is in some states arguably illegal to gerrymander purely for political purposes. But they would never say that. But this is state law, and it's going to vary from state to state. Mike in Fairfax, Virginia. Hey, Mike, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? Quick question on what the Attorney General said, and the devil's always in the details.
Yeah.
If the union and labor groups are exempted from the same reporting in Sunlight, and then pro-labor groups or advocacy groups have this burden put on them, seems to me a bit
unfair. Why would the unions and labor groups be exempted?
Well, when you read in the details of most of this regulation that's being proposed, they're not considered under the same...
They're not 501c4s, but unions have had to disclose this stuff ever since 1947. That was part of Taft-Hartley.
Yeah. As long as the reporting requirements equal for everyone, that's great. And I also think it's ironic that Obama's Organizing for America is now rebranding itself Organizing for Action and becoming exactly one of these shadowy super PACs that everybody's so afraid of.
Well, yes and no. They're disclosing all their donors. They're operating on a completely transparent basis, as unions have had to do since 1947. So,
and in the last election, why did Obama take some of the things off of his website that require you to put address information for the political donations?
Probably because there's a whole different website and a whole different, it's a different thing. I mean, you're not giving to a political action
committee
anymore.
A lot of reports that he got a lot of money from foreign sources, and there's no way to verify it because they took that off the website.
Well, that would depend on which website you're talking about. There was a political action committee, a PAC, that was working on behalf of Obama. I think Paul Begala was running it, but that was not coordinated with the White House. If you're giving money, if you gave money to the Obama campaign, then you're a matter of public record. If you gave $100 to Mitt Romney, if you gave it to the actual presidential campaign, Mike, I can look you up. I can see your home address. I mean, it's all right there.
Yep. And it's fine. All I want is an equal set of rules that everybody follows.
I agree.
And I don't want to carve out for this union. I don't want some special treatment.
Well, this is the thing. The unions have never been carved out. Ever since Taft-Hartley in 1947, unions have had to disclose 100% of their budgets. Those disclosures are totally transparent and always have been. So anybody who's saying, oh, well, unions operate under different rules. Well, of course they operate under different rules. They're a different type of nonprofit corporation. That's like saying, well, the local dog catcher operates under different rules. Well, yeah, of course.
Well, I've talked to people who live in Wisconsin and were involved in some of the union efforts up there. And there is no way to determine how much out-of-state money other unions threw into that problem for the recall on Scott Walker.
There might not have been the day that the recall happened, because you don't file those reports until 30, 60, 90 days after the fact. But you could look back at it right now, I guarantee you.
Okay. I still haven't seen the final numbers of who pumped money into that on both sides.
Well, you won't see the money that went through the 501c4s, which is, like Karl Rove's. He had two. He had one that was a super PAC, which actually does report. And then he had a 501c4, and they both had Crossroads in their name, and I forget which one was which. The one that was the 501c4, you'll never know who gave money to that. And to the best of my knowledge, there is not an equivalent of that that was involved in the Walker campaign.
Okay.
Now, maybe there was, but I don't believe so. Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. I get it that you don't want the left to have an unfair advantage. I agree with you. I think that, you know, we should all be standing on the same ground. That's, you know, rule number one of fairness in small d democracy. Jason in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening to 1350 AM. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you. It's been a while. I was just wondering on the gun issue, and I think you're more of a supporter of guns than people would honestly realize, but I could be wrong on that. Let me ask you this. In the history of government, them being the people that killed 191 million people over the last century, as opposed to guns or cars or drowning or disease, do you think they're more responsible as gun owners than we, the people?
Jason, I think that's a
point. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I believe, Jason, in your mind, the answer to your question was embedded in the question, so I'll let it stand and leave you with the last word. We'll be back. Okay. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Yeah, we will. We will. And Tom Hartman with you, and in the studio with us, I'm so pleased to have with me Senator Sherrod Brown of the great state
Good
of Ohio.
To be here where it's warm,
indeed.
It is cold out.
Cold
man.
Outside, yeah. And congratulations on winning your re-election. It's great
thanks.
To have you
thanks.
Back
Good
in the
to
Senate.
Be back. Thank you.
What are your thoughts on this whole discussion that's going on around the Obama presidency? Is this going to be and not just the presidency, the Senate, the House, the gestalt of the people. Yeah. Now, is this going to be the are we looking at the end of the Reagan era and the beginning of an Obama era, sort of like, you know, the beginning of the FDR era? Do you think that this is a turning point in America?
Well, I think it can be. You mentioned FDR. You think about the I remember hearing on your station, on your show, the speech about the Royalists one time. But when FDR met with a group of progressives and they pushed him, and he said, I agree with you, now go make me do it. And I think that the president's sort of asking for that now. I think that he wants to move in this direction. He knows, as I think the agreement, the House-Senate presidential agreement on the budget at the first of the year, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think was a affirmation that trickle-down doesn't work and that you build the economy from the middle class out to the working poor, to people that aspire to the middle class, and it helps upper-income people, too, when the middle class does well. I think the president – I think that was an affirmation of that. I think the president's continuing that. I think the speech was about that and moving in a different way from what the right wing has said has worked when clearly it hasn't.
Yeah, 32 years of trickle-down and you know, a few drops off the edge of the table.
Yeah, you look – particularly the last 10 years – from 2000 to 2010, the far right had their tax system in place, major tax breaks for the wealthy, a lot of military spending, and you know there was almost no net job growth in the private sector, and most people didn't get a raise for those 10 years.
Yeah.
And so clearly since 2010 with the Recovery Act and the auto rescue and forcing us some trade rules and all, we've seen some manufacturing jobs come back. We lost 5 million in the 10-year period. We've grown back about 500,000, nothing close to what we need, not nearly enough focus on wages and job growth and manufacturing. But starting in that direction, I think the State of the Union or the inaugural address is an acknowledgement to move forward.
When Nancy Pelosi was running the House of Representatives, they passed legislation that would have done away with the incentives that companies have, like when Bain Capital, ironically toward the end of the election, took down that Sensata plant in, I think it was in southern Illinois, the company that made sensors for car engines, literally broke the factory down, shipped it off to China, rebuilt it there, brick by brick, machine by machine. And
got a nice
break for doing
right.
it.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And you know, in the House, they passed legislation that would have done away with that. You know, you can make money shipping jobs off seas and would have provided incentives for companies that bring jobs back. It was filibustered in the Senate. I'm curious your thoughts, A, on what's up with the filibuster, and B, whether there's any possibility of that kind of trade legislation. And that's really only nibbling around the edges, I think,
right.
you know, really trade, serious trade stuff. Might come out of the next couple of years.
I think filibuster first. There will be some change in the filibuster rules. I think it won't be as much as some want. I think that I know Reid is talking very seriously to McConnell. McConnell sees the handwriting on the wall that he's got to compromise on this. There's still some fear from some of my colleagues that if the Republicans take the Senate, what how they would jam us. You look at what happened with Right to Work in Michigan. Yeah. They had a window and they took advantage. I mean, in some ways,
well,
look at
Virginia,
you know,
yesterday.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, as you've pointed out on the show, when you look at sort of historic context, when Democrats win, we typically do things like pass health care and Lilly Ledbetter and Wall Street reform, and never close to perfect bills, but at least generally good legislation that moves the country forward. When Republicans win, they much more likely try to figure out ways to expand their power. They in state after state went after voting rights. They went after collective bargaining rights in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, elsewhere. So because of that, I think that we're going to see us move a little more aggressively in the Senate. And I think the country, Republicans have problems now. I mean, they know that they didn't cave on the debt limit. They put it off, but that's a bit of a concession because they know they were wrong on that, and they know the public's not doesn't work with them for the doesn't work for them with the public. I think you're going to see more of that. And trade enforcement is a really good example because, you know, whether it's trade enforcement on currency, as our legislation passed the Senate bipartisanly last year and not in the House, or whether it's what you're talking about, I think there is real opportunity there. I mean, most of us, I don't know how you justify getting a tax break when you ship jobs overseas instead of the other way around.
And yet that, you know, but most people don't even know. Right. I was surprised, frankly, that wasn't a big part of the campaign. I know you talked about it a lot in Ohio, so probably Ohioans know about it, and Bernie talked about it in Vermont. Yeah. But I don't think most Americans knew that the Republicans shot that down.
Yeah, I think that's right. And if they know the tax break even exists, they kind of know about it when it happens in their community and a company gets shut down and the workers who are losing their jobs often have to train or at least unbolt the equipment or whatever they have to do and to help to facilitate the move that their bosses are getting tax breaks for. And then that community finds out and then it's too late.
Yeah.
And I think Democrats don't do as well among white working class voters, especially if they're non-union, nearly as well as we should. And part of the reason is it's our fault. I mean, I hear people say, well, they don't vote their own economic interests. Well, that's their decision on how they're going to vote and what their interests are. It's our decision to educate better on issues like outsourcing of jobs and tax breaks.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it seems that my first hour actually was about the history of small d democracy through the Enlightenment, starting with Thomas Hobbes and you know, getting into
just John another
Locke
show
and
Thomas Hobbes. Yeah. They're all over the radio.
I do it a lot, actually. Jean-Jacques Rousseau and Jefferson and Jefferson's comments about Patrick Henry. It was a bit fascinating stuff. But basically, the conservative worldview and Russell Kirk in his book, The Conservative Mind, 1951, which is the Bible of the modern conservative movement, starts out with Sir Edmund Burke. I mean, it starts out with Hobbes. It starts out with this idea, this conservative idea, that people are essentially evil and therefore we have to protect ourselves from the rabble, as John Adams used to refer to average voting people, and you know, what the first conservative president we had. And the liberals, the progressives, have historically taken the notion that people are functionally good, and we want to have as many people involved in the process as possible. You know, a much more small d democratic process. And
although interestingly, progressives also know that economic powers, when unregulated, will take advantage of the public.
Yes.
So we understand that fundamentally, and you can see it in 100 different ways. So we believe in sort of an equalizing power of government to protect the public when people who have more economic power. I mean, that's one of the reasons I'm working on the Wall Street on legislation to break up the six largest banks is because people with that much economic power, the largest six banks, their total assets used to make about 20% of GDP. Now it's about 65%, these six banks. They have too much economic power, which ultimately can damage democracy. And it's not just the super PACs and all of that. It's the advertising to the public. It's the influence they have on the public debate. It's their influence with pundits, and except for the Tom Hartman show, of course, in other places. And that really is potentially undermining democracy, that kind of economic power.
So what are the things that are on your radar screen? You say you're working on breaking up the banks.
Yeah,
I'd like to know more about that.
Yeah,
but also, what are
sure,
things
sure. To me, it's continued focus on jobs, on manufacturing, on how to see wages begin to grow in this country again. And you know, that means funding infrastructure from highways to bridges to community colleges. It means a particular focus on manufacturing and bringing the tax laws in line with the American public's interests, not only investors' interests who might outsource jobs. And the bank issue is we have the breaking up of the largest six banks, requiring them to divest some of their assets. We got 35 votes when I brought it to the Senate floor back 3 years ago with Senator Kaufman of Delaware, who has since left. And I know there'd be more votes for today. And I think that when you see somebody like George Will and Mary Madeline, people like them say the banks have too much power, we should consider that proposal. You're hearing it from Fed governors. You're hearing it from progressives and have all along. There is some, it's one of those issues. I think it's time will come, and the time is closer, way closer than it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Joe Stiglitz was writing the Financial Times a couple of days ago about how a job or jobs, you know, jobs have a disproportionate impact on an economy, that you can cut taxes and you can create some economic stimulus. You can spend money. You'll create a certain amount of economic stimulus. You create jobs, you create a disproportionately larger economic stimulus than either tax cuts or spending. Why is it that Americans are so focused on cuts and on taxes, and nobody's talking about jobs?
Well, certainly not nobody, but I.
But yeah, I know you are.
Well, way more than me, but the public. I mean, we've let them manage this debate too much. That it's not a revenue problem; it's a spending problem. Well, really, it's a jobs problem.
Yeah.
And I think that's why when you called off the air, you were very complimentary of the president's speech. I mean, the inaugural address, and I think that's a recognition on his part that it's got to be about jobs. It's got to be about people making decent wages. I mean, you know, one of the curious things that's happened in this beginning recovery, Ohio's unemployment rate's gone from around auto rescue time, 10.5% now down to under 7. But I do a bunch of roundtables around Ohio. I was in an affluent county the other day in north of Columbus, and a woman said there are more, as the unemployment rate's coming down, there's still more people in food stamps on SNAP, more than there were the year before. And that's all about wages, that people are going back to work, but too often in a $12 or $10 an hour job,
right,
and not even making even close to a livable wage. And so they are getting SNAP. And so in some sense, the government's subsidizing these low-wage jobs. Taxpayers are paying these companies that underpay their workers.
Which is a perverse incentive. Senator, right. Senator Sherrod Brown is with us. We'll be back.
Sure.
SherrodBrown.com is still your website, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Stick
around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
If you got a question for Senator Brown, give us a call at 866-987-THOM. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Senator Sherrod Brown with us, and Kermit in Meadow Bridge, West Virginia, watching us on Free Speech TV on Dish Network. You're on the air with Senator Brown. Kermit?
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 Okay, Kermit from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Yes, sir.
South
Carolina. I'm sorry.
Yes,
okay.
Sir. How are you? Look, I enjoy your show. I really enjoy listening
Thank
to you.
You.
I wanted to ask the senator, when Obama first came in office, his first term, my understanding was Nancy Pelosi wanted to have him put the jobs program into effect, but they didn't. They went with the health care. So now I want to know, what do they have to do with the health care to get that program going, or are they going to try to do that?
Okay.
Jobs
program. He said
I think the president, you remember when he was taking office, and the Republicans, as they campaigned in 2010, obviously convened and mentioned this, but when President Obama took office, we were losing 800,000 jobs a month. The month he was inaugurated, the second month it was something like 700 or 600 something. And you know, we've had job growth for most of the last 3 years now, almost every month, but we're not where we ought to be. The president, I mean, he didn't do exactly a jobs program at the beginning, but he did what he needed to do to stop the bleeding in Wall Street. He did what he had to do in Wall Street, and he did the Recovery Act, which really did make a difference, although it's hard to argue it did, because things weren't good, but they were better than they would have been if he hadn't. But to make a too long an answer, try to make it shorter, he's tried with jobs programs that continue to be filibustered. Mm-hmm. The House won't move on them even if we could pass the Senate. Some of it's as simple as a long-term transportation bill that would build infrastructure that would create jobs immediately and build a foundation for more jobs. Part of it he's done with trade initiatives, with trade enforcement. There's a lot more we need to do, and I think the inaugural speech yesterday suggested he's going to be more aggressive with it. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Our Okay, let's see here. Senator, this is, we have a fill-in call screener. Danielle's not here, so I'm trying to decipher his. Dan in Harlan, Montana, you have a call, you have a question for Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you. I was just wondering, why are they not taxing products that come from companies from overseas? And when they call entitlements, Social Security is already paid for by us, and Medicaid is mostly, or our medical is paid by us. But two, I was wondering why senators, congressmen can do a term in service, and then they get a retirement.
Okay. Three questions.
Okay, well, I'll start with third. We don't. I know that's made its way on the internet that if you serve one term, you draw your salary for life if you retire. Do you think this many people would work that many terms if they did? It's just not true. I mean, you got to be in for a much longer period of time. The congressional pension system is generous. There are some private pensions that are as generous. So nobody should ever whine about it or complain about it, but it's nothing like you read when you hear. I mean, we pay into Social Security. We pay for our health insurance if we're on the congressional health care plan. I wasn't for many years because I promised I'd pay my own until Congress enacted health reform, which we did. And now I'm on the health care plan, but I pay into it. In terms of Medicare, I agree absolutely with you about the term entitlement. The people in Washington that dress like this and pundits call it entitlements. I call them investments or social insurance. You pay into Medicare and Medicaid. And I mean, sorry, Medicare and Social Security, but I consider Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security absolute essential investments in our people. And no matter what Mitt Romney said or what people say today about fixing entitlements, I just think they're wrong about that. Third issue was
trade. Why not tariffs?
Yeah, why not tariffs? I think that it's obviously more complicated than that, but it's generally right. I mean, we don't have strong enough Buy American provisions. It's pretty hard to tax. I mean, if we were to tax products overseas from coming from overseas, it would mean other countries would do the same. Some already, we try to knock these tariffs down. That's fine. But what we've done with NAFTA and CAFTA have clearly accelerated the dismantling of American manufacturing. And, we need a very different trade policy. So, I don't think it's ever going to be sort of, we're going to charge a tax on everything coming in. That was many years ago, but I do think there's a more aggressive trade enforcement and better trade policy we can do.
Somebody needs to come up with the Singapore-Haiti-Australia trade agreement, so we can call it SHAFTA.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yes.
NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA. Yeah. But, you know, seriously, we've got, and we have about a minute and a half, we have a bunch of our trade partners are using value-added taxes as functional tariffs. They knock them down on imports, and they raise them up on imports, and they knock them down on exports. Any chance of a VAT tax?
Well, probably not soon, but that's something that Congress should look at. If we do a VAT tax, it looks a lot like a sales tax. We would need to replace. We can't just add a VAT tax onto what we have now. It would have to replace some other tax so the middle class wouldn't get hit because the consuming public would get hit hard by a VAT tax. The other problem with VAT tax is that seniors are not paying. Most seniors don't pay income tax now. All of a sudden you hit them with something that looks like a sales tax. It's sort of not where they should have to be in their lives. So we'd have to do something to equalize it more. But Tom's exactly right that almost all European countries, starting with the French literally 50-plus years ago, enacted a VAT tax which helps their exports and keeps our exports, makes our exports harder to sell
in
those countries.
Doing it now.
And China's doing that kind of thing plus the currency issue. And so a lot of these trade issues, a lot of them are individual industry unfair play, if you will, by our trading partners. Some of this just wash across the whole trade map,
right?
Like VAT tax and like currency.
Right. Senator Sherrod Brown, thanks so much for being with us today. It's an honor to have you in the studio.
I'll be back. Thanks, Doc.
And tomorrow we'll be back with more. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Get out there, get involved, show up, participate. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.